Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today spent over 20 years working for the Forestry Commission in Germany before leaving to put his ideas of ecology into place. Well, now he runs an environmentally friendly woodland in Germany where he's working towards the return of primeval forests, as well as caring for both wild and domestic animals. Well, I'm an avid reader, but for all of the books we read, trees have to die. So my guest today understands how they live and has dedicated his life to making sure that they live well. He can also tell us about the hidden lives of animals. Peter Verleven, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Georgina.
Your books, The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate, Discoveries from a Secret World, and now your second book, The Inner Lives of Animals, Surprising Observations of a Hidden World. They are both so utterly fascinating. And yet you tell me, and anybody that cares to listen, that you're not a writer.
No, I'm not a writer. I'm a forester. And yeah, you could say that my wife nearly forced me to write all those things down because I usually make guided tours and the books are something like a written guided tour.
And so they came out of the tours that you were making around the woodland?
Yeah. Usually I'm more like a storyteller and I love to talk with a group or an audience. But many people have asked, where can we read more about it? And I had always to say, no, I don't know anything. And my wife said, Peter, please write up. After years of resistance, I began to write down all those stories, and here I am.
So how did you get involved with nature?
I don't know really. I've been always interested in nature. I've kept spiders in glasses and water turtles in the aquarium, and I breed an egg on the heating pillow of my grandma. So there, one day I had a little chicken which regarded me as its mother, which was really just for the first days funny. Afterwards, it was a lot of work because it liked to accompany me even in the restroom and in bed and school. And then the English teacher, after a few weeks, decided that he better kept it. And from there on, life was one experience richer for me. It was the first and last time I tried this, but I tried many things, and all those things till now are written down in the book.
And they're just, they're so, so fascinating. I want to start really with trees, because you talk about how they feel, how they communicate, and it has really utterly changed the way that I think about forests. I mean, they talk, they count, they feel pain, they suckle their young. This is all evidence-based stuff that you have in your book.
Usually scientists write in technical terms and no one likes to read it. And therefore, I translated it in everyday's language with emotions. For example, when I say mother trees suckle their children, then it's not that they take their children out of the soil at their breast. No, they suckle their children through a root system, and I describe that. But while describing it in pictures like that, it's like, in Germany we say, like a cinema picture in the head, which is going on, and when you can feel emotionally with trees, then you understand them much easier.
Mm. And when you started to connect emotionally with trees, that's really when you changed the way that you dealt with forests.
Yeah, right. Let's say it like this. When I studied forestry like the German Forest Commission, like to see foresters, or like to have the foresters to look at forest, like raw material, like oxygen producer, like water purifier, but not like having a relationship with trees. And my relationship to nature was always based on emotions, and therefore I had to suppress them for a time, and I was unhappy about that. And then I changed my view. I let my emotions out, you can say it like this. And then I began to view forest once new again. And then I discovered all those little things, like this old stump, which is supported by surrounding trees, an old stump which is several hundred years old, with any green leaf and still living. And it's burning sugar in its cells like we do. It needs energy. And the only explanation is that this energy comes from the surrounding neighbor trees, which share sugar solution with this old fellow.
Just like us looking after our grandparents.
Right. And perhaps for the same reason why we have old people. I think the old people in former times were something like a social brain for developments, for experience. The people there, they didn't have Google or Wikipedia or things like that, and they had to ask older people for their experience. And it is still a better experience than a computer, because a computer don't have emotions.
Mm. But now, of course, the trees have the Wood Wide Web.
The trees have the wood wide web, but it's an emotionally wood wide web because it's just there for sharing important informations, for prevent damage to other trees, to keep up the social system. And when we see our social web and see which persons are using it, then sometimes our world wide web is destroying social relationship. Trees wouldn't do that.
Well, so in the process of discovering all this, your job basically became untenable and you needed to move into an area where actually you could nurture the trees. You needed to find a way to do foresting in a way that was beneficial to the trees rather than just as a resource.
Surprisingly, I stayed in the same forest district and changed the way of managing this forest by convincing the mayor of the village, which owns this forest. And we started changing forestry, for example, without using heavy machineries, using horses instead, and creating reservations where protected areas where trees can live their wild life. And instead, we create, for example, a burial forest where trees were sold as living headstones. We made new adventures out in the forest so people could bring money into the forest without taking timber out. And all in all, the little village gets more profits, the forest gets more protection, and altogether we're more happy.
And this beautiful book tells us exactly why and how. Now, like most good books, it's got a good dollop of sex in it. Tell us about arboreal love.
For example, beech and oak trees, they make appointments for sex. But just every 3 to 5 years. And that's to avoid that the seeds, the oaks, the beech nuts are fed by boars, for example. And trees don't like that. Therefore, they make breaks of several years. And then there's no food in wintertime for wild boars and other big mammals. And then the population goes down. And then all together bloom and produce fruit. Hundreds of thousands of tons, and there are just a few animals to feed them, so most of the seedlings will survive. And how they arrange over hundreds of miles, we don't know so far. Mm. We know that they do, but not how they do.
We also know that they're capable of learning and perhaps even counting.
Yeah, that's research from a German university on apple trees. Trees don't want to come out with their leaves too early. Because we always can have a late harsh frost and then the leaves will freeze and that costs energy, that hurts a tree. So trees are careful, is it really spring? And therefore they count warm days. And just as when a certain amount of warm days is reached, then they come out with their new leaves. And therefore they have to count, and that's proven, and they have to have a memory, because otherwise they would count every day one.
That's just quite extraordinary. I mean, there's so much in this book. I mean, we could be here forever dissecting every chapter. So just before we leave the subject of trees and go on to animals, you talk about street kid trees and how trees in cities are entirely different.
Yeah, I've seen them in London today. Platan trees, sycamores, which are like lone wolves or like street kids. They grow up without parents. A childhood in a primeval forest is very slow. The first 200 to 300 years, a little tree has to grow very slow in the dark shadow of the mother trees. And that's by purpose, because when you have a slow youth grow, you can become very old as a tree. But here in the cities, the tree grows up without parents. They grow very fast, and that we love that because we have very fast and in a short time big trees, but that's an unhealthy growth. And so the trees can become very old, perhaps just 100 or 200 years. We think that is really long, but that's it's a short time. And they are disturbed, for example, by streetlights. Trees have to sleep at night. And when the streetlight is burning the whole night, then a tree dies earlier. It's like we have to sleep with full light during the nighttime. That's also not good for our health. And that's proven that trees which are living near a streetlight, which burns the whole night, will die very much earlier.
It's quite extraordinary. And the whole book is packed full of information like this, but been given in such a way that it's scientific information that we can really easily understand. How have scientists responded to it?
Scientists are disturbed about the emotional language I use. And that's exactly the difference between scientific reports and the books. We work perhaps more than 90% on emotions, love, happiness, when we are angry or whatsoever. That are emotions, and that they are most important for our life, much more than our mind. And when we bring all the emotions out of a text, then it doesn't work. We won't read it. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm talking in pictures, like, for example, that the mother tree suckle its seedlings and not explaining the biochemical mechanisms behind it. That's how the book works. And everyone instinctively know, that's how force works. But for scientists, that's not accurate. That's not 100% like they like to talk. But who says that a text without emotions is human language?
I mean, the book's been out for a couple of years now. Yeah. Have you found that it's made a difference in the way that people are relating to woodland?
Definitely, yeah. That's because the people began to love trees. And perhaps that's another difference to scientists. Scientists always aim at our mind, and I like to aim the heart, at the heart. And when we love trees, for example, then we don't need laws to protect them.
We also need laws to protect animals, and it seems that there's an awful lot about them that we had no idea about. I mean, you make the point that emotions are different in each individual and perhaps between species, but that the basic emotions are probably exactly the same.
They are exactly the same. We always say animals are working on instincts and we are working on our mind. Besides, that is not true. What is the most important thing for your life? When you would have just one word to choose, what is most important for your life?
Love.
Love. That's an emotion, and emotions are the language of instincts. Emotions are just for instincts. So the instincts are most important for us, not our mind. And when we say animals are working on instincts, then they have the most important thing.
And we're talking now about your very latest book, The Inner Life of Animals, Surprising Observations of a Hidden World. If love trumps hunger, does it? I mean, so my dog Bella is here and she's sleeping very sweetly. Isn't she terribly well behaved?
Right. Perfect.
But I just wonder how that works. Say perhaps that the love of a dog for her mistress. Yeah. And in fact, I guess I shouldn't be using words like that because I don't own the dog in that sense of emotionally owning a thing.
Yeah, I think the dog has the same emotions than we have. And our emotions are caused by hormones like oxytocin. Mother love, the strongest love ever, is caused by oxytocin, a hormone. And this hormone you can find not only in dogs, but in goats, in horses, and even in goldfish. And scientists don't know what it does in goldfish, because to detect love in goldfish is perhaps a step too far in the moment. But we have to be careful because nature hasn't invented one way for the human species and million ways, other ways for other species. No, there's just one way for, let's say, mammals or perhaps every animal in different grades, but that's not important. It's in general that are very similar emotions and which drive similar instincts.
So let's go through some of the chapters in this book, because I started turning pages down and then I just thought I was going to ruin the whole book because there's an interesting fact on absolutely every page. You start off by talking about mother love and you give us the example of squirrels.
That was one observation I made in our garden while playing with our little children. A squirrel came to us very slow and falling down every 2 or 3 seconds. It was on a very hot summer day and I thought this squirrel was exhausted, perhaps sick. I didn't know, a disease and perhaps it's dangerous for my children. And I worried about that. And I saw something like, it looked like cancer on the head of the squirrel. And when the squirrel came closer to us, I realized that it was a little baby. And this squirrel, this mother squirrel, was rescuing this little squirrel baby. And even though it doesn't get enough breath to take on this hot day, it doesn't matter. It's the mother love was that strong that it went on bringing this little baby to a safe place.
It's quite extraordinary. Yeah. Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian. And I'm also using firewood in my stove. Although I'm writing about social bands of trees, I'm not a plant. I can't make my own sugar with leaves, so I have to take food from other living beings. So for me, more important is how we treat them before using them. Mm. And I think there is a lot of things to be done. For example, we have to have reservations for plants. We have to have reservations for animals and in general, to take more care about it. When we divide nature in animals and plants, the main difference is how they feed and not what they may feel. Because when we know that trees, for example, have a memory, that they have family bands, that they care actively for their offspring, what about wheat? What about peas? All plants, all wild plants are able to do things like that. And why should we regard them as beings of second class?
Mm.
So for me, it's more important to treat also plants in a better way than we do it today.
Can we focus now on pigs? Because yeah. there's a chapter on pigs which is just extraordinary. I mean, they appear to be, I mean, are they much cleverer than other creatures?
I don't think so. That's also interesting. We regard animals which are intelligent more worthful, or we feel more sorry for them when they are treated bad than with animals with low intelligence. But when we think that love, for example, is most important for our life or happiness, that has nothing to do with intelligence. And when we even can find oxytocin in goldfish, what about flies and their little brain? Perhaps they are not intelligent, but what we know is that they move their legs while sleeping. Perhaps they are dreaming like we.
That's extraordinary. And yet, I mean, are there ways to test that? There may be ways, I suppose.
There are ways to test that when they are usually very brutal by measure things in their little brain. So this brain will be destroyed by measuring things. So science is sometimes very brutal, but it is proven that there is light in this little brain and that there are things going on. But what they are thinking, we are not able to detect this till now. But for example, in rats, scientists are able to see what they are dreaming.
How?
For example, when in daytime they are moving through a labyrinth, then you can measure the electricity of the brain. And the special brain waves, they show where in the labyrinth the rat is. And when the rat is dreaming of the labyrinth, then you can see where in the labyrinth in its dreams it is.
It's all just quite mind-blowing. Now, there's such a wonderful experiment in here with pigs and knowing their names.
Yeah, that's an experiment to bring a little more order in a stable. Usually when you feed pigs, all pigs come together and they are fighting for food. You teach them to listen to their names and to make a row. Then all is in order without fighting and it is all calm while feeding. And the pigs are waiting until their name is spoken.
And you can really teach them that.
You can teach them that, but that's also an interesting topic, how we look at nature. My daughter once said, when we are thinking that we are more intelligent than animals, why we are always trying to teach them our language? Why don't we learn animal language? When we are more intelligent, that should be much easier for us.
Mm. And talking about naming, could it be that they call each other's other names? Do they give each other names, do you think?
On pigs, that's not proven, perhaps because it's not researched. But on ravens, it's researched. And ravens are calling each other by names. They have names amongst each other and they have a language. So far, 80 words are detected. There should be a lot more words. And they are using similar things in their language. For example, when a friend that they haven't seen for years comes back, they greet the friend in a high voice. And when someone returns, which they don't like, then they greet this raven in a deep voice. And that's exactly how we greet with friends or people you don't like. So be careful, or perhaps the next time when you're invited, hear exactly how you are greeted.
Now, ravens love shiny things. And you write a bit about mirrors and animals' interaction with their own reflection.
That's also a special topic because we try to find intelligence like we are used to find it, the mirror test. Therefore, when an animal gets a dot of paint on its head and looks in a mirror, then we regard it as intelligent, that it is self-conscious, when it understands that the dot is at its own head and that it's not another bird watching back out of the mirror. And this mirror test is positively done by dolphins, by chimpanzees, by raven birds like scrub jays or ravens or crows. But, for example, dogs are not able to do that. And then scientists say, okay, dogs are not that intelligent, but perhaps dogs are not interested in mirrors.
I find it extraordinary when I'm walking Bella, who's still lying very well behaved.
Perfect,
here. Yeah. When I'm walking her and we come across another dog of the same breed, there appears to be absolutely no recognition. And then I thought, well, of course, how would she know what she looks like?
Yeah,
but I wonder about that sort of that within a species recognition.
Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps that's a typical human thing to be interested in how we look like. Perhaps it's not interesting for dogs. I don't know if there's research being done by primitive cultures, let's say 10,000 years ago or so, if they were interested in their mirror picture. So I think all we can say is that animals which pass the mirror test are using it in the same way we do it, But to make a conclusion of the intelligence rate, I don't think that this is the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to Bella, and we've just been out on Primrose Hill, and she was running around after a ball, and it seemed to me she was having fun. Can animals have fun?
Yeah, they can have fun, like we do. Fun is nothing important according to evolution, because we waste energy for nothing so far. And that you can all only do when you're something like rich in food or time or whatsoever. And yeah, we can watch that also on dogs or on raven birds, which make a sled tour on a snowy house roof, or on crows, which plays with dogs by picking them in the tail. And the crows are faster, and they have a lot of fun while the dog tries to catch them, and it's not working. So, yeah, I think animals can have a lot of fun. They can even laugh. We know nowadays that dogs can laugh, apes can laugh, that rats can laugh. It's hard to detect laughing on different animals because they react different than we, but they can laugh.
How does a dog laugh?
Breathing very fast, like we do when we laugh, but it's a mouth winkle up like we do, but it's exactly that. It's an excited, very fast breathing.
Bella, knock, knock. So you talked about trees counting, but in this book you talk about horses counting too.
Yeah, horses can count. Therefore, they need to have imagination about the future. For example, how often I have come to the meadow this day, and at which time or which visit I'm going to feed them. And they know exactly when I bring corn or when I put another piece of meadow free for them. So they have an imagination about the future. They can count how often I have appeared this day. And yeah, I think that's for me more important, that horses have an imagination about the future, because many people think animals are not able to think about their future.
Mm.
And you can see that on old horses. Old horses fear to lay down and not to be able to stand up again. And from one day on, that is not possible because they are too old and too weak. And they feel that point of time approaching, and then they don't lay down again. Laying down is easy. Standing up is hard. And therefore, they have to have an imagination that when they have to stand up in the future, that could be not possible. And therefore, they now don't lay down. So they have a feeling and a combination and thoughts about the future.
And they can feel shame and regret too.
They can feel shame. We see that on our two horses. The one is the boss, the other has to follow. And when the horse which has to follow, Bridgie, that's my horse, when she does something wrong and I talk to her, don't do this, let that, and her boss is watching it, then she feels shame and she bends her head away. She's, what do we say when you tired
and yawning.
Yawning, yeah, and that's something typically for someone who feels shame. Yeah,
Peter, I think that you've done the most tremendous service for all of us, making us understand trees and animals. Now I understand that you're also doing it for children. You've written a kids' book.
I've always made guided tours for kids since my own kids were 6 years old, with school kids, and that's exactly the new book about in German. Just in the moment, just in German. From 6 years old, they can experience on themselves or together with their parents the forest and the animals by reading it, by watching the pictures, or making some experiments or games. For example, blowing through wood, that's possible. And then you can discover on yourself how trees transport water. That's too complicated to explain it on radio, so you have to read the book.
Peter, if there was one thing that you felt that we should all really take away about how it is that we engage with the world around us, the natural world in particular, what would it be?
I think I would go on an emotion, on love. When you love nature, when you love trees, when you love animals, then you always do the right things.
The hidden life of trees, what they feel, how they communicate. Discoveries from a Secret World is out now. It's published by Greystone. And Peter's latest book, The Inner Lives of Animals, Surprising Observations of a Hidden World, is published by Bodley Head. Now, if you're interested in following Peter's work more closely or going on a guided tour of his forest and learning about forestry, he's set up a nature academy in Germany. There are more details on www.wollebens.de. Dash Waldacademy.de, or just go Google Verlieben's Nature Academy. I'm sure you'll find it. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. My thanks to George McDonough, Kieran Banerjee. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.